The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben.
Sup.
Sup. Sup with you.
You know, living the dream here in the valley.
You look like you're in a dream state right now. Well done.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited to hear your interview with Jonathan Van Tulleken and Christopher Ross, the director and DP of Shogun.
That's right. They did the first couple episodes together, and they're great. It's really a wonderful conversation, and we dive into a lot of the fun stuff of that show. And we talk a little bit about the article that came out that was saying, like, hey, you're not crazy. Your television is blurry. And it was really just a whole, like, you know, story about anamorphic lenses. So we dive into that a little bit. But it's a great conversation, and that will be coming up in just a minute. But first,
close focus.
Before we started recording, we were lamenting AI, and this is another AI story. So what is it that...
I don't frequently lament AI, and I goof around with AI image generation. I've talked about it a lot on here. We've talked about Sora. We have had Michael Cioni on here, who's using AI for what I consider to be vastly positive things within our industry and within our workflows. So I'm not an anti-AI person. If you're tuning in for the first time, I'm not here to shit on AI. However...
Hold on a second while I grab this toilet paper.
There's a Hollywood Reporter article that Alana brought to our attention, but also my good friend Jonathan Mangum actually sent to me because I pitched him an idea that I thought would be a funny TV pitch that involved AI. And then he just responded by sending me this article. And the headline is Hollywood Nightmare, new streaming service lets viewers create their own shows using AI. And it's a company called Fable, and they're creating AI-generated cartoons.
Animated series, various levels of animation. Yeah.
And so you as the
showrunner.
Yes. Yeah. You would be prompting the pre-built characters and pre-designed voices and pre-designed everything. And it would use AI to build it. And they actually did, as a proof of concept, they did an AI generated episode of South Park that you can watch. And I'm just going to lay this out. This is the old thing about, like, you know, put 1,000 monkeys at keyboards and eventually they'll write all the great works of Shakespeare. We're the monkeys.
That's right.
They are trying to get us to create the shows for them. And it reminds me of something that friend of the show, Randy Tom, posted on Facebook. And it's a quote from Daniel Ek, Spotify CEO. This is the quote. Today, with the cost of creating content being close to zero, people can share an incredible amount of content. And also anyone who's paid any attention to me over the last year knows how much I love it when we refer to the fruits of our labor as content.
You know, it's really funny because Sony was just in the news as well, lamenting the cost of movies. I guess movies not being the same as content, not even close. But,
well, the thing is that content is such a catch-all word that everything is content. Like, there's a YouTube channel I watch called The Bike Farmer, and it's a guy showing how he tunes up bikes and how he builds bikes from scratch and how he finds and rehabs bikes. I love it. But that is content. This is not a professional filmmaker telling a story. This is a guy who is a bike guy showing you bike stuff, and I like bike stuff, so I watch him do it. This is his content. No problems. I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with when the CEO of Spotify is referring to, let's just say, the collected works of name your favorite artist, musical artist of all time. I'll just go with the Beatles because they're kind of big.
Sure.
They're kind of a big deal. I hear they're, but like the
calling
the,
it content.
Yeah. The Beatles and Snoop Dogg and whatever, Beastie Boys, the Pixies, Nirvana. That's not content to me, and it makes me very angry to have our stuff referred to that way. And this Fable thing, what it is doing is it is asking us to now as content people for free. Well, actually, I take it back. In the Hollywood Reporter article, it mentions that there would be a profit sharing thing.
Assuming that they choose yours, assuming that whatever you do, all the work you put into it, because here's the thing. I read the article too. It says there's prompts, but really it's like They want you to create individual scenes. They want you to go through and enhance dialogue. They want you to change shots. They want you to do an awful lot of work, it sounds like, to make an entire bit of content by yourself. And if then yours gets voted on to be included, there's some sort of revenue that they'll give you after the fact. So it's like, who knows how much that will be. They're
YouTube has been revenue sharing for a long time. I mean, like, I'm not saying that something good couldn't come of this, but this is the tech bro way to approach creating stories. And it's not artist driven, and it makes me very angry. The artist then becomes the AI.
Well, I'll give you one more. I heard people the other day talking about how Hollywood has to compete with YouTube. And Hollywood, in my opinion, is not really competing with YouTube or anything else, or going out and walking your dog.
I mean, Hollywood is losing to YouTube because YouTube is the most streamed service on all smart TVs. Like,
YouTube
Netflix
is
a distant second to YouTube.
YouTube is not making Everything Everywhere All at Once. YouTube Correct. Is not making Outer Range. YouTube is not making television and movies. YouTube is making diversions for most people to watch when they're in the bathroom or at the airport or wherever other
people are watching it on their television. That's why it's competition, is because the most streamed service on your smart TV statistically is YouTube. YouTube is watched more than any other streaming service on televisions. That doesn't include when you're sitting on the crapper. That isn't on your phone. That is on your television.
They are not making the same stuff.
YouTube isn't making anything. They've experimented with that. I don't know if anyone remembers YouTube Red. Yeah, giant flop.
So they're relying on you and me and everybody else out there. Look at us. We're putting this podcast on YouTube. I mean,
this podcast is content. Go on.
So in the same article, they say, well, our AI right now can write an episode of The Simpsons better than The Simpsons can. And I watched The Simpsons yesterday, and I'm sure they absolutely cannot. I think
they can't do it without? They can't do it without sampling the entire data set that is this, whatever, 40-year library of The Simpsons.
That's 100% true.
They can't do it without stealing the IP. They are clear to say, like, we're not going to make South Park episodes. Their South Park thing was just a proof of concept because they don't own the IP. And I think they're right to say, okay, we'll create our own original IP. Here's my prediction. And I could be, you know, I'll eat these words disgustingly as I apply for a job at the post office because there is no more entertainment industry anymore. But these shows are going to suck. These shows are going to suck, and they're not going to get any better because they're written by AI. And if, in order for them to be good, people have to go in and just keep, you know, rejiggering
coming up with
the
million
prompts
new prompts and, exactly yeah, yeah. to
like,
get it to
maybe
say what
they
it wants.
Maybe they get a little bit better, but it's the monkeys at typewriter thing. It is purely monkeys. It's AI monkeys at typewriters. And I don't want to crap on anyone with an innovative, cool idea, but everyone says this. Why is AI writing movies and making art and not fixing global warming? Why is it AI? I mean, honestly, I look at what Shioni does with Strata, and it's like, that's what AI should be doing. AI should be doing grunt work and solving problems that no human brain can calculate. Why even try and make a cartoon with AI? But go ahead. I personally say this is the Quibi of tomorrow. It will be a punchline if it even gets big enough that anyone is aware that it exists. That's my prediction, and I'm often wrong about things.
You know, I'm going to go slightly more optimistic than you. I think they will make a couple of good episodes. I don't think they're all going to be good. I think they'll make a couple of good of whatever it is that they do. But the ones that are good, I'm going to say, have the most human intervention, like major human intervention. So essentially what you would be doing is having a human who goes through and figures out all of the really creative stuff, and they use the AI for the in-between and the grunt work and everything else. That's my prediction.
Maybe. Maybe. I find this kind of thing, it's anti-creative. And again, to keep citing Michael Cioni, it's like, the thing about art is that art is satisfying to make. That's why we do it. That's why we tell stories. And I feel like we don't just want to consume stories that come from anything, especially AI, which is basically going to be an average of all other stories. We want to create new ones and we want to explore new stuff that we've never used. Now, I feel like AI is inevitably going to be a part of that because I think like AI is going to be involved in the visual effects pipeline and the editing pipeline and the sound mixing pipeline just because it does grunt work faster than the rest of us. And maybe if I mean, like I've already fallen into this trap of like I'm trying to make an image and I go into Photoshop and I just try generating shit until I get something kind of cool. And often it's something I wouldn't have come up with. But in terms of like making the whole thing, it's going to make me into a misanthrope because I don't want to watch TV shows and movies that are written by AI. And I also don't want to see everyone exploited by yet another tech startup that's going to like suck the creativity out of them. The person who's going to sit here on one of the shows that they're creating and beat their head against the wall, coming up with good scenes and stuff like that, that person could take that same creativity and go write their own original thing.
For sure.
And it would be better. And yeah. Even if it was seen by fewer people, that person could one day be a great writer instead mm-hmm. of being a prompt engineer for an AI animated series for an IP that they don't own.
Yeah, agreed. You know, there is a place actually where AI is being used and has been used for years that most people don't realize. If you've
Spell
got a
check.
Camera,
no.
If you've got a camera that was made in the last, probably 3 or 4 years, certainly from like companies like Sony or Panasonic, and I know there's one in front of you right now, that actually has AI going on inside of it to improve the autofocus. And one of the things that it does, which is very clever, and Panasonic has gotten really, really good at this, is that when someone is not facing the camera, it doesn't immediately focus somewhere else because the face is gone. It's now realized, oh, this is the back of someone's head. I should still keep focusing here because then I know that eventually they're going to turn around and that's still the subject. Like that sort of like little technology that is now pretty standard in most cameras that have been released in the last couple of years, that's all AI. That's AI programming that they've programmed into these cameras to understand what a human is, what a bird is, what a plane is, what a train, a car.
Yeah.
That's why you've got all these little like icons that you can switch because
all day long.
The training went on for autofocus to detect and then stick on things and be sticky rather than to start hunting all over the place the way autofocus used to work.
Anyway. My head's going to explode, so let's go ahead and get to the interview and let's hear some real artists talk about making art.
Let's do it.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by cinematographer Christopher Ross and director Jonathan Van Tulleken, and they are the creative team behind episode 1 of the new hit television series Shogun, which if you haven't seen it, it's on Hulu, and you absolutely should. It's also on FX, of course. Shogun is a visual and entertaining extravaganza, and I have to say that the first couple of episodes in particular have so much going on. There is so much stuff in this show. I had to watch it twice. It was amazing, all of the different levels and the intrigue and the subterfuge and the gore and just, I'm going to ask you at some point who you think this show was made for, but I can give you the answer to it right now. It was made for me. I loved it. So, hey, for those who have been living under a rock and don't know anything about Shogun, can you give me the logline elevator pitch? What is Shogun? What's it all about?
I would say it's a great epic story of political intrigue, of power, of romance, of the discovery of what it is to be foreign from both sides. It's about cultural clashes and sort of incredible moment within world history as well, of sort of empires discovering each other. And yeah, fundamentally, I think it's a great story, great character driven story with tons of drama and tons of action. And yeah.
Well, I think that's a great log line. So it takes place in 1600 feudal Japan, and you have got a largely Japanese cast. You shot largely in Canada, if I'm not mistaken, if I recall correctly from the American Cinematographer article. You're using German lenses, and it is I assume that neither Jonathan, you or Christopher speak Japanese. What was the crew like? Was it, how did this all go down?
I would say from my end, it was amazing. The international affair of it was incredible. You know, Chris and I had done a project before this, which I loved, called Trust, with effects as well, which I think is how we both ended up sort of coming to this with Danny Boyle. And that had a lot of Italian in it. And I found that I loved working in another language that I didn't speak, because it meant that you were not giving line readings. You couldn't give line readings. You had to sort of direct in a much more pure way of dealing with the bigger arcs of the scene, of the character development, of, you know, without getting into sort of very, very macro stuff that isn't helpful. I think you could just look at it as an overarching thing and just feel the emotion. And so from my point of view, I loved it. Like I, you know, and on this, and so I'd had a sort of experience on that of how that could work. And then when I came onto this, I had a great translator who would be there right next to me with an iPad with a phonetic version of the script as well, of the Japanese, and sort of following along with it so that I could definitely make sure I knew where I was in the scene. And of course, once you've done a scene once or twice anyway, you already know it. You kind of get a sense of where the beats are and where the flow is. And then it kind of freed me up. It freed me up to just watch it in a much more pure way. So that side of things. And then I would also say that the Japanese cast were, I mean, absolutely amazing. I mean, Hiro Sanada, who is our lead and also a producer and was there on set all the time in a, such a supportive way, not in a sort of way of looking over my shoulder, in a way where he would speak to the extras. He would be there just making sure that, you know, we were being authentic and faithful, but also in a way allowing us to break some of the rules as well of Shinjuku cinema. And so I felt like it was a really enriching experience on my end.
Yeah, Chris, how about for you? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, echo what Jay was saying about the great international community that came together to make the film, you know, a heavy Canadian presence, a heavy Japanese presence, some Brits thrown in there, some Danes thrown in there, a Norwegian. It's a big cosmopolitan mix. And I think that is part of the reason for it having such universality and it being able to travel so well. But from an imagery standpoint, what you're trying to do is take the words that the cast are saying, that a character is saying, and create some sort of image that reinforces those words. You know, it's, well, not necessarily, you know, some, you just a close up of some person speaking is appropriate. But in a deeper level of cinema, what you're hoping to achieve is some sort of emotional resonance with a character that is in tune with what they're saying and synchronous with what they're saying. So
let's get into that. Let's get into that. And I mean, look, one thing I can say about Shogun, as much as anything I've seen on television in the last few years, is this is ambitious. This is an ambitious, ambitious show. There is so much going on, you know, of course the international aspect, but there's so much going on visually, and the visual aspects of what's happening on the show and the drama that's taking place, because it is this swashbuckling action, drama, intrigue, political thriller, all kind of rolled into one. When you get, I'm assuming, the show Bible for this, when you get the scripts, when you're going through this, episode one, you got to set up the whole series, the whole, you know, 9 hours of television to come behind that. How do you start breaking that down? What do you do to create the look of a gargantuan project like this?
I mean, I would say it started literally from, I got sent the scripts, and, you know, when I'm on something of this scale, when you're, you know, going up for a pilot, like I would immediately make a lookbook. So I immediately started thinking of images, and I knew that I wanted to do it with Chris. So I also immediately rang Chris Ross and said, hey, like, I've been sent this amazing script. Here are some of the things I'm thinking about. And Chris then really fed into that as well and gave me a bunch of references. And we were spitballing all sorts of things. Like, I started out thinking about Blade Runner, Apocalypse Now. I was trying to find things that I felt captured what the original novel had done, which I loved as a kid. You know, I read it when I was 13 or 14 and was blown away by it. And then I also felt Justin Scripps had such an amazing boldness and subjectivity and this very, very contemporary feel as well. Like, they just had such ambition with on the page in the writing. And so I felt like, okay, how do we do that? How do we make this intoxicating, dangerous, immersive place come to life on screen? And so, yeah, that was the first bit. So I started putting together a lookbook. Chris gave me a ton of great influences as well. Then I built that out. We did my pitch, and then I got the gig. And then the minute Chris had come on board, we just kept building that out. And Chris made a sizzle reel for it. You know, that was absolutely awesome. And, you know, like Assassination of Jesse James and The Revenant. We knew, Chris, you can speak to this more, but my recollection is that we immediately sort of said, for the opening block at least, even if that then there was a visual arc, there was a visual arc to the show as characters settled into the environment. For that opening block, we really wanted to play with subjectivity and disorientation and feel the world, but be with our characters. So we knew we wanted to do anamorphic. And we also really talked about wider aspect ratios and feeling that sense of the world, but being really close to our characters. So that was where, that was quite an early conversation, I felt like. And then it kind of, yeah, built from there. But Chris can speak.
Yeah, Chris, I want to bring you into this. Tell me a little bit about this sizzle reel. Is it like a rip-o-matic? What did you do that like kind of created, helped this visual motion cacophony of all of these different influences and sources come together to sort of get your creative opinion across?
Yeah, we do in the process of making what it is that we do, you know, we make a lot of lookbooks and various things. And there's a lot of still images that we talk about all the time. But in the world of cinematography, you know, the atmosphere of the imagery is a combination of light and time, basically. And so in order to create an idea of the like emotional, atmospheric and character development, it's good to put a reel together. So in a way, it's just a three-dimensional extension of Jay's lookbook. So it's like, let's take a look at, like Jay was saying, Apocalypse Now, and focus in on the Heart of Darkness journey and a little bit of The Revenant, a little bit of Jesse James, a little bit of No Country, some of Ran, Throne of Blood, Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, you know, Hero, etc.
And so Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. So by pulling these seemingly random genres, some that are more relevant than others, obviously, you know, Akira Kurosawa's Jidaiki films are a key genre similarity. But what's interesting about Jidaiki is that it's kind of like a Shakespearean formal universe that has very strict rules. And so it's like, how do we do to the Japanese jidaiki genre what Justin Kurzel and Adam Arkapor did with Macbeth? How do you make that collision of very formal tragedy script style and genre style feel like a modern contemporary Western narrative cinema?
So you that's the kind the, of you the asked basis the great of the, question. Yeah. How do you do that? So is it like, I'm guessing here, because I've seen different types of these over the years, like, is it edited together like a music video? Is it like someone is reading a portion of the script? What is the construction other than just a montage of different shots? How do you put that together?
Well, we had Atticus Ross. We knew he was on board for the score at that point. So we got some of Atticus's score that was like closest to what we felt the Shogun score would be. And that we definitely laid under to kind of tie it together. And in fact, I think, Ross, we made two mood films. We made two sizzles. We made one that was like an ephemera mood film for like, you know, which, to be honest, I'm not sure if it became that useful because the story was so packed with actual story. But we had like how we wanted to shoot shadows and how we wanted to shoot time passing and moments, like moments of ephemera that weren't connected to the story. And then there was like a sizzle reel that was much more, you know, hey, this is the action. This is the character. These are, yeah.
So I have it right here on my desktop. So it's music from The Defiant Ones, you know, the brilliant Atticus Ross channeling his deepest, darkest inner world. Yeah, and imagery that we love. So, you know, and the reason for doing it is you can have a lot of conversations and a lot of meetings about a lot of things. And that's what filmmaking is. But really, you sort of have to distill all of that into like, I mean, it sounds a bit pretentious, but into like when you're deciding on how fast a dolly moves or the rate of a jib during the course of a shot, it's kind of got to like resonate like a tuning fork in the heart of the operator, in the heart of the key grip. So the idea with the mood film is that if you just watch the 4 minutes of the film, you pick up on the heartbeat and the pace, you know. And so hopefully that, you know, that's the reason why it exists, is to try to convey in a short zero conversation what you should be feeling, how you should be composing an image. And so the idea is that that film then becomes a reference for everybody that's working in the camera department, lighting department, grip department, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if they watch that, they kind of get an idea of what I'm trying to help Jonathan create, basically.
Yeah, ultimately, it sounds like a great communication tool. It sounds like you're using it to communicate the idea, the vibe, the intention on a big macro scale so that it makes it easier for when you are communicating the micro, when you're communicating the details and how to actually get it done.
Just to that point, I think the other thing we did a camera test, and the camera test was, you know, I guess a couple of weeks before, and it was really wasn't just like people holding cloth up against a sort of, you know what I mean, a wall, or like some characters just sort of standing in front of the camera in makeup. It was like we went to the sets and Chris lit them, and we did moves, and we had the characters. We had Anna do some full moves with some weaponry. We had them on horses. We had Hero with his hawk. It was like a little movie in and of itself. And we set to Atticus's score as well. And that is still one of the most beautiful things, I think. Like, I loved it. I still have that. And that was like, yeah, that was another thing where it was just took all of that thing that we put together with the lookbook and the scissor wheel and then actually made it real with our cast. What was great about that was, A, it got all of us to allow to get our feet under the desk together. So everyone sort of, you know, got to work a little bit without the pressure of it being the first day. But it sort of felt, you know, people were in character. The actors were starting to imbue, you know, we did little vignettes, little scenes. And also it allowed effects and Justin and everyone to see our intention. And so everything was held up to the light. There were no surprises. You definitely don't want that, like on a big show. You want everyone to be like, we know what it is now. And so on the first day, actually, it was kind of awesome because everyone's like, oh yeah, this is the show. We know what the show is. We've seen it already. We've had a teaser of it.
Yeah, yeah. The first episode in particular, it takes place, I want to say almost like two different sorts of worlds. And one of them looks cold and wet, coastline of Japan. And I know that Canada is standing in for this, but were you guys shooting in winter? It looks like winter. It looks like dark days. Can you talk a little bit about, and of course, I'm not even getting into the whole boat sequence that takes place before that, but what time of year were you shooting this and how much extra were you having to add to create this mood, to create this time of year in the show?
Yeah, we added a bit, like we knew the show was going to run into the winter. So the show ran over Christmas. So we knew it was going to get super bad. We knew the weather was going to get real sort of Vancouver rain and wet. And so I think we'd always thought of like the village, Ajira, being different to, you know, Osaka, and them having different fields. One's this rich, opulent world and one's the world of the sort of the peasantry. And so we definitely, in our episode, we in fact got blue sky on a couple of occasions. We were like, ah, damn it, we don't want blue sky. And definitely Chris can speak to it, but there was definitely a little bit of some quite serious flagging on a couple of the pot boiling scene, I remember. But like, we brought in the rain for the, you know, the first time Cosmo meets Yabu, you know, that was, we had rain coming down, and then it did actually start raining. It was raining in that scene as well. We were adding a bit. I know later in the series, they did not have to add. It was just given to them. But we definitely set out with the intention of making that side of things like wet and filthy and the other side sunny and...
It's very successful. And quite often, you know, interiors, they're only seem to be lit by candles or flames. And of course, in the 1600s, yes, if you don't have the sun and you don't have a candle, you don't really have anything else. So it makes perfect sense. The lighting, actually, I got to say, it really plays to this color palette, too. And you've sort of got a slightly different palette in the rural countryside than you do in Osaka, where everything is a bit harsher. Everything is a little bit more contrasty. Everything is a little bit less saturated in the colors. When you go into Osaka, everyone has got these incredible outfits and there's a little more saturation. Can you talk a little bit more about how you collaborated with the various teams to create the different looks of these different spaces?
Yeah, Jay, I guess that's a collaboration with Carlos Rosario, the costume designer, and Helen Jarvis, the amazing production designer. But Jay was working with them for a considerable time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, we thought a lot about how rich can we push this? How obviously we looked at a lot of different, like in terms of the paintings on the shoji, you know, looking at materials that felt like, you know, really pushed it, like going for that silver with the cherry blossoms and making, definitely defining the rooms, one room being very gold, one being silver, one room reflecting Mariko. And then looking at the clothes as well, you know, talking about like, okay, how does this palette reflect differently to the villagers? And we definitely pushed, you know, I think Carlos was awesome at pushing those costumes and making sure that we really felt that opulence. And because the colors in the book are, you know, it's brown and green, basically the two warring factions. And so we really went like, all right, and this was very much with Chris's influence of going, okay, let's put gold. When we say brown, let's say gold. Let's say it's golden brown. And so that was always been put in. And then when we say green, let's get all these great textures of silk and feathers and gold woven into that as well. And so trying to make that side of things really pop. And that was definitely, you know, that was a process. That was a process with all the departments and all of us talking about it. And then equally on the villagers' side saying, all right, what is the village colors? You know, it's the blues and the grays and like, really those are the outfits, and it's much more natural fabrics that aren't going to shine, that are going to sort of absorb the light. And so yeah, there was definitely a lot of discussion, and it went all the way on until we started doing those final camera tests.
I know, I was going to say, and from a light perspective, there are changes in the color in terms of the variance of the amount of blue in the soft light that we were using on the different sets, the amount of sunlight that would be bouncing around, the use of the rapeseed oil lanterns in the palace rather than down in the village meant that that light is a more golden, warm, opulent light than the bare open fire that is more red, orange and sort of angry and primitive in a way, which is the light of the village. So it's just trying to make very small philosophical variations that sort of, you know, add up to bigger variations across the scenes.
Yeah. And I think it's really effective. I feel like definitely there's a pull towards one end of the color spectrum versus another, depending on where you are. And it's subtle. Was there a lot of reflected light? Was reflected light something that you leaned on really, really heavily for this?
The sort of the big philosophical takeaway from me from a light perspective was in learning about the architectural design of the spaces. So just as an example, the, you know, Torunaga's room in Osaka Palace has a wide opening of 16 feet or so with an ingawa over the top of the veranda. And therefore, there's very little direct sunlight that penetrates the space. Basically, that's the design of the ingawa, is to minimize bleaching of fabrics from the sun. And then the floor of the sets is all tatami mats, which are bamboo sheeting with, you know, wrapped in cotton. So it's kind of like a muslin bounce. Then the main structural components of the set are these wooden oak beams everywhere, and then a certain number of shoji screens, which are the paper thin screens, and the ornate designs of the silver gold reflective wall structure. So what you have really is an amount of light that enters, bounces up off the floor, spreads itself around the space, and with the reflective material, with the reflective wood paneling, and with the reflective silver and gold, you know, leaf inlaying, etc., all of that really comes to life with the reflection of a large light source, basically. So that's kind of the idea behind the lighting, is to take the architectural design and push light in a kind of natural but cinematic way.
Yeah. I want to change gears a little bit here, because not often do television shows get a write-up the way that Shogun got a write-up in The Ringer. And I'm assuming that you guys saw this article, because I believe you're both quoted in it. I know, Jonathan, you're definitely quoted in it. I believe, Christopher, you were quoted as well. Yeah. But I don't know if it was exactly the same story you thought that you were when you were being questioned about how it was going to turn into sort of this whole big thing about why television is blurry, which I thought was quite interesting, because it reminds me quite a bit of controversies going back maybe 20 years ago regarding letterboxing, where a less sophisticated audience out there said, oh my God, why are there black bars on my television set? And it seems to me that the culture has moved on now to a point where that's not even, it's not even a thing. And of course, 16:9 and widescreen televisions helped this, but your show is 2:1. 2:1, a very popular and wonderful aspect ratio that I'm a proponent of. And we won't go too far into the technical weeds here. I do very technical things Monday through Friday, and this show is about art, craft, and philosophy. So really, I want to bring in the art, craft, and philosophy aspect to this conversation here, which is, there's a philosophical sophistication that goes into making something look artistic, that makes something look beautiful, that makes something have a stylized, a point of view. It doesn't look like everything else. And I believe that you kind of just have to hope that your audience comes along with you, and then they can let it wash over them and they can take it in for what it is. But as the creatives, as the filmmakers, as the people, I know this is a long preamble, but I'm getting to my question right now, which is, how do you deal with this? And is it even part of the discussion for you at all? And for the people who haven't referenced the article that I'm talking about, I assure you in the show notes for this episode, we will put a link to it so people can see, can read what I'm talking about here. But how much, when you're going through the prep and you're doing, is it even a concern of you that the audience also comes along, that the audience understands what it is that you're doing when you create the look of a project like Shogun?
I mean, you know, it was awesome working with Justin and FX because there was a huge level of trust. There was a huge level of like embracing the idea of being bold, that we wanted to create something that stood out, that and didn't just stand out for the sake of it, but that had genuine sort of artistic intention behind that. And that, you know, we had real thought and philosophy behind the look of the show. So it was definitely not done sort of casually or just to be different for different sake, but to sort of, you know, really bring us into a point of view. And so I would say once I've approached something like that and worked with my closest collaborators like Chris, I'm at that point then I don't give a lot of thought to the rest of it. The only thing I would say, because it bugs me myself, is like, and why I like working with Chris is I hate it when stuff becomes muddy in the sense of where you can't see anything and it's all just nothing on the TV screen. And I love it like where darkness is intentional and darkness is silhouettes and darkness is cutouts. And, you know, if you go dark, it is for a reason. But other than that, I think you just have to go with God and make the thing that you feel does best for what you're attempting. And that if you start wondering what people are going to say on Reddit, God, it is a worm. It is a worm. Yeah. It is a dark wormhole. But Chris, you can maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would concur with that sentiment. You know, when we embarked on Shogun, one of the things that we talked about doing was that we wanted to be very subjective and very first person. And Justin really loved the look of The Revenant. Obviously, Chivo won an Academy Award for that work, you know, that is somewhere between a 12 mil and a 21 mil, but mostly on a sort of 14, 16, you know, in very close proximity to the cast members. So we embarked on a really big lens test, a really big, you know, combination of cameras and a really big combination of lenses, all sorts of spherical, all sorts of anamorphic lenses from loads of different, you know, providers. And the idea is at that point, to be like, I have no predetermined sensations. It's like ego free. We're just going to shoot some tests. We have a wonderful supporting actor, supporting artist dressed as a samurai against some shoji screens. And we're going to do this test and it's going to be a thing. And then what you see when you watch The Rushes back is you have a bunch of people in a room that have an emotional connection to a particular image. And so it's not from my perspective as a cinematographer, I shouldn't be thinking about image fidelity per se, although it's a, you know, as a factor. I should be thinking about what speed of pushing on a character is going to make you beguiled by Mariko's eyes. At what speed is the jib down on Torunaga's back with a roll focus? At what moment in that jib down do you think that Torunaga is the leader of the free world? So it's like, it's about emotional resonance and about connection to character. And you get that connection in Turner's painting of the fighting Terra Marrera, or Van Gogh's Moonlit Night, or Monet's Water Lilies. The amount of fidelity, smushiness, deconstructivity, all of that adds to the art form. And so it's not about the work that we make together as a collaboration is an emotional response to the juxtaposition of millions of images and millions of words, and none of us knows really how to do that. We just experiment and hope for the best.
I love that. I feel like that is, you know, in some ways the best possible answer I could have received to that question. And bravo, I appreciate you guys breaking it down this way. Gentlemen, Jonathan, Christopher, thank you so much for being on the show. It was such a delight to talk to you guys. I really can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, thank you very much. A delight.
Thanks very much for having us.
All right, so that was the team behind the first couple episodes of the hit series Shogun. Thank you so much for being on the show. Jonathan and Christopher, great conversation. Really enjoyed chatting, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
And now, Short Ends.
So, Ben, it is our famed Short End time of the show. It's the time we talk about our weekly obsession. Is there something that you are all about, something that that you can't stop thinking about this week?
Yes.
All right, what's that?
It's a four-part documentary that you can find on Tubi. It was originally made for Screambox, and it's called RoboDoc, The Creation of RoboCop. I knew you would like it.
You know, I'm really into sort of like alliteration and punny titles, so that's wonderful. RoboDoc.
Yeah, so it's directed by Eastwood Allen and Christopher Griffiths. The cinematography is by Christopher Griffiths and Gerald Ridenour. And I gotta say, I'm a fan of RoboCop, you know, maybe because I'm a child of the 80s. RoboCop was a pretty big deal to me. But anyone who hasn't seen RoboCop, it is... it's the kind of movie that doesn't get made very much anymore because it's like a hard R-rated satire of kind of what at the time was the current world of Ronald Reagan's America through this kind of dystopian filter. And it's hilariously funny. And it stars Peter Weller as a police officer who gets almost killed, but then is turned into a super weapon, RoboCop. And in this four-part documentary, it was also, I think, Paul Verhoeven's first American film. He'd made a bunch of other movies, but it was his first movie in America. And he went on to do like Total Recall and Basic Instinct and Starship Troopers and let us not forget Showgirls. interesting track record as a director and a provocateur, at least. And this movie is very provocative, and they kind of show it's kind of a warts and all behind the scenes documentary making of, and they interview like everyone who's still alive, who is a part of it, except unfortunately, one of the people I was really hoping for was Rob Bottin, the guy who created the RoboCop suit. But Rob Bottin has retired from the industry and nobody knows where he is. And no one knows what became of Rob Bottin, the guy who did the makeup effects for The Thing and The Howling and all these amazing movies from the 80s.
Well, has Alana Cody tried tracking him down? Maybe it's possible we could find him.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. If we could talk to Rob Bottin, that would be like, I would geek out like I've never geeked out. They don't talk to him, and he is, as far as everyone knows, still alive. But they talk to all the stars. I was surprised Ronnie Cox is still alive. He's like, got to be in his 90s. They interview him extensively. They interview Peter Weller extensively, like the whole cast and crew and Paul Verhoeven. They talk to the DP. They talk to everyone. And it's wonderful. Every beat of that movie, every decision they make, and that movie is a movie of excesses. So when someone gets like shot, it is the bloodiest shooting up scene you've ever seen. When there's an explosion and you kind of realize watching this is like, oh, they were all extraordinarily dangerous explosions that they were doing. I mean, like nobody got hurt, and it's funny and everyone's funny in it. Like everyone really comes to life. Paul Verhoeven sounds like he was kind of a handful as a director, and he kind of owns it. Peter Weller, same thing. They kind of seems like he had his moments, and he literally just owns it and kind of says like, I'm not like this now. I hope I wasn't too bad. But they also show like how they came up with all the sound design and the makeup effects and the visual effects. Cause you know, like it's got like a bunch of robot heads up display stuff that at the time had to be basically hand animated. They didn't have CGI. And if you haven't seen RoboCop, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's like a B movie with A movie treatment, and it's very smart and knows exactly what it is. Can't recommend it highly enough. But this documentary also just a love letter to RoboCop.
Yeah, I remember seeing RoboCop in the theater, and I went with my parents, and they immediately regretted taking me.
Really?
Yes, they were like, they were like, oh, why did we take you to this? They thought it was going to be something completely different than what it was.
What's funny is in the documentary, they actually kind of addressed the fact that RoboCop, although it was a hard R-rated movie, had like kids' toys.
Yeah, exactly. It really did. It had kids' toys. Yeah. There was lunch boxes with RoboCop. It was really, you know.
And,
it was...
and they made a cartoon. Like, it became kind of a kid's franchise after the fact. Anyway, so what is your pet obsession of this week?
Well, I just finished the second season of Outer Range. Have you seen Outer Range?
I started watching the first season, and it's not that it wasn't great. It's that I was just brain addled and didn't stay with it. And I think that that story repeats a lot through the peak TV years where it's like, hey, this is a cool show and I just don't have the bandwidth to take on one other great show.
Season one came out in 2022. Season two really just dropped not that long ago, and I got caught up. Here's the thing. It's a solid show. It's definitely a solid show. It won't be for everyone. And I think the reason it won't be for everyone is part of actually what makes it great. So, like, I use this expression with the utmost praise. It's Lynchian. There is something David Lynch about Outer Range. And not just like any David Lynch. It's like Twin Peaks sort of era of David Lynch. And it's sort of that serialized story where you're not exactly sure where it's going. You think you kind of have the pieces, and then something else happens and someone acts unpredictable, and then you don't really know where you're going to be next. And I kind of love that. I kind of love that because it keeps you guessing. You're not exactly sure which way the wind is blowing. Now, granted, it's not a Twin Peaks ripoff. It's not totally trying to be Twin Peaks. It's not going off the deep end of season two of Twin Peaks. But there is like this little bit of steeping. It's like my tea was slightly steeped in David Lynch here, and I called it Outer Range. I don't know how else to describe it. There is...
You teabagged David Lynch.
There's a little bit of that. So okay. Josh Brolin is fantastic. Lily Taylor, always great. It's an incredible cast. And there's all of this sort of like fun stuff in different eras that play against each other. And it's time travel, but it's like very low tech time travel. It's about as low tech time travel as you can get. It's time travel and like natural environmental phenomenon. And that's just not something you see done every day. I think the closest thing might be Time Cop, if you can remember way back then where, you know.
Sorry, not Time Cop.
That was Jean-Claude Van Damme. Right. I meant Time Rider. Do you remember Time Rider? He rides his motorcycle like into a mountain and like comes out.
Produced by Mike Nesmith in the 80s. Yeah, yeah.
Was it really Mike Nesmith?
The guy who directed
Elephant Parts?
Yeah, yeah. Mike Smith produced that. He produced Repo Man. He produced a lot of really cool stuff in the 80s.
Really? Oh, wow. And Time Rider?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So, Ben, I think that's just about going to do it for this episode. Where can people track you down? They want to track you down.
You can track me down at benrock.com. That's where you can find all the information you ever wanted to know about me, probably. And if you want more, you know, direct message me. Don't send pics. But find me there. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Threads. I'm on Instagram. I'm on everything but TikTok. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. And of course, most of the social things, except TikTok also. Yeah, no TikTok for me. Sorry.
Yeah.
So Ben, who do we have to thank this week? Who helped make this show possible?
Was it just the AIs? Was it all AI? We had
AI?
Fable Studios did the whole show, and you and I are both AIs. You know, at this point, somebody could probably sample both of our voices and just kind of, you know what? If somebody out there is so inclined, I'd love for you to make a fake podcast with Ilya and myself. You could use you have my permission to make a fake one. Make me say whatever you want.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Yeah.
We should thank the person without whom like this wheel would not turn is Alana Cody, our producer, who kicks all the ass and has you working pretty hard. You're doing more interviews this week than I am. That's
saying something, since I know you're doing some too.
How did that happen?
She is kicking ass and taking the names. It's like she's tattooing them across like, you know, her right bicep or something.
We have to thank her. We got to thank Ben Katz, our intrepid editor, who I apologize to profusely for my camera malfunction. He could just look at my file where it's black and just be like, snip, snip. Still, didn't make your life easy, Ben, I apologize. I think you're awesome, and thanks a lot. And then, as always, Kay Zalatrakshi, who I got to hang out with today. He was helping me out with some computer problems, but we had nice long chats about creative stuff and things that we're hoping to do. And he's, as always, one of the most creative and awesome people you'll ever meet. Check him out at musicbykays.com. He created every little tiny molecule of music that you hear in our episodes was created by Kay Zalatrakshi. Ilya, take us out, please.
Well, if you're on YouTube, please be kind and subscribe. And until next time.
All right.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.